Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for Friday, April 19th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Judith Linden. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines on the front page of today's Register. Our AccuWeather forecast says breezy today with clouds and sun, winds west-northwest 12 to 25 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight, winds west-northwest 7 to 14 miles per hour. Cooler tomorrow. Expected high today is 61 degrees with a low of 32. Breezy today with clouds and sunshine. Winds west-northwest 12 to 25. Partly cloudy tonight, winds west-northwest 7 to 14 miles per hour. Saturday's high is expected to be 53 degrees with a low of 33 degrees. Breezy and cooler. And Sunday, high of 62 and a low of 39, mostly sunny and warmer. Looking out the rest of the week, we've got highs in the 70s, but they are, in the 60s, but they kind of go down throughout the week, and lows in the 40s, 30, upper 30s and 40s. Sunrise today, 6:28 a.m. Sunset tonight, 8 p.m. Moonrise today, 4:02 p.m. and moonset today at 4:51 a.m. Headlines on the front page of the Register today: Des Moines Council skirts rules on public meetings. And a couple pictures with the heading Adventureland unveils new scares, new eats. And we will get the full story later in the front section of today's paper. And then under the fold, we've got one story entitled Iowa GOP Lawmakers Reach Deal to Speed Up Flat Tax, Lower Rate. Now, here's Judith with our first story.
Thank you, Scott. Iowa GOP lawmakers reach deal to speed up flat tax and lower rate. This story by Stephen Gruber Miller. Iowa Republicans have struck a deal to speed up and slightly deepen a series of income tax cuts, and they intend to move swiftly to pass it as the legislative session enters its final days. The bill, unveiled by the top Republicans on the House and Senate Ways and Means Committees, would take Iowa to a 3.8% flat income tax rate by next year. Iowa's income tax is already set to go up to a 3.9% flat rate by 2026, thanks to a law Governor Kim Reynolds signed in 2022, which is still phasing in. The state's top rate this year is 5.7% and will drop to 4.82% next year unless the law changes. Senator Dan Dawson, Republican of Council Bluffs, who chairs the Senate Ways and Means Committee, said, "We are accelerating the promised tax cuts, taking it lower, and returning an extra $1 billion back to Iowans." Lawmakers said they plan to pass identical companion bills, Senate Study Bill 3207 and House Study Bill 752, through committees Thursday, setting up a possible final vote Friday. The tax deal released Wednesday does not go as far as Reynolds' proposal in January, when she called for lowering the rate to 3.65% for 2024 and 3.5% in 2025 and beyond. Some House and Senate Republicans also had proposed eventually eliminating the individual income tax altogether. Although the bill does not go that far, GOP lawmakers said it does preserve their ability to cut taxes further in future years. Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican of Wilton, who chairs the House Ways and Means Committee, said, "Are we done? No. I would like to continue to go down as low as we can, but we as House and Senate Republicans are continually making sure that our tax relief plans are paid for and responsible. The deal is a sign of progress as Iowa lawmakers work toward adjourning the 2024 legislation session in the coming days. The legislation also makes other changes to Iowa's tax laws, including tweaking last year's property tax overhaul, which limits revenue growth for cities and counties. In a statement, Reynolds called the bill a common-sense compromise. She went on to say, "Cutting taxes has been a priority of mine since taking office, and I am pleased that the Senate has introduced an income tax cut that further reduces and accelerates the implementation of a flat tax rate that will benefit every Iowan who pays income tax," she said. If state revenues drop below state spending during a fiscal year, the bill would take half of the difference from the state's taxpayer relief fund to cover the costs. The other half would come from the state's ending balance. That part of the bill would be repealed on July 1, 2029. Dawson said the bill provides a good cushion if state revenues do not meet expectations. He went on to say if the economy outperforms, we won't have to use any of it. The state ended the previous fiscal year with $2.74 billion in the taxpayer relief fund. The amount is expected to rise to about $3.6 billion in July when the fiscal year ends. House Republicans say they expect the taxpayer relief fund to be at $2.66 million in 2029 once that part of the bill expires, before rising to $2.73 billion the following year. Brad Hartkopf, a lobbyist for the Iowa Association of Business and Industry, praised the bill in a Senate subcommittee meeting Thursday. Hartkopf said, "We appreciate all the progress that has been made over the last several years to make our tax plan more competitive for both individuals and businesses. We believe this bill takes us in another step going in that direction, and we support it." Mike Owen, executive director of Common Good Iowa, told the subcommittee that lawmakers should have pursued more targeted tax policies like strengthening the earned income tax credit and creating a child tax credit. "We could have done so much better this year on targeted tax cuts to those who actually need help getting by. There have been a lot of nonsense talking about competitiveness here. We have been competitive for many years. Some people have not wanted to acknowledge that." Reynolds had also proposed changes that would lower the unemployment taxes paid by businesses and lower taxes on commercial child care centers. Neither of those changes were included in the bill released Wednesday, although the tax change for child care centers is included in a separate bill. Kaufman said of the unemployment tax system, "I completely agree with her that it needs to be addressed. We just made a decision that that's probably a 2025 issue because of the significance of how big a piece of policy that is and the amount of time that we have left." The bill gives counties the ability to eliminate county compensation boards, which review the salaries for elected county officials and recommend increases. Kaufman said, "In my opinion, county compensation boards are one of the largest contributors to an explosion of growth of property taxes. You've essentially got a group of friends getting together and recommending raises for each other." Iowa law tasks the compensation boards with annually reviewing salaries for county supervisors, auditors, treasurers, recorders, sheriffs, and county attorneys by comparing salaries in that county to other comparable counties, the private sector, and the federal government. Under current law, county boards of supervisors may not raise elected officials' pay by more than the compensation board's recommendation. If the board of supervisors decides to reduce the pay recommended by the board, it may do so only by an equal percentage for all officials. The legislation makes changes to a property tax law passed last year that limits how much city and county property tax revenue can grow. Under current law, if a city or county's total assessed property value grows by more than 3%, It must use some of the excess revenue to reduce its general fund levy. Different tiers specify how much the government must reduce its levy, depending on whether its values grow 3% to 6% or more than 6%. The legislation proposes changing those thresholds. Under the bill, if a county's revenue grows by 2.75% or less, it will not need to reduce its general property tax levy. The bill creates new tiers for cities and counties whose property values grow from 2.75% to 4%, from 4% to 6%, and more than 6%. Des Moines City Manager Scott Sanders spoke to Thursday's Senate subcommittee, asking members to allow cities more breathing room before they would have to use their excess revenue to lower property taxes. He said, "I would ask, with adjustments moving forward, that there is an opportunity for a community like ours to reasonably grow at 3.5%, and that there are no penalties until you get above that." Republicans this year are in the process of approving two amendments to the Iowa Constitution that would make it more difficult for the legislature to raise taxes in the future. Both chambers have passed a proposed amendment that would require a two-thirds vote of the legislature to increase Iowa's individual and corporate income tax rates. Currently, all legislation is approved through a simple majority vote, 50% plus one. The Senate has also passed a proposed amendment that would require Iowa to have a flat individual income tax rate rather than a graduated income tax system if the state imposes an income tax at all. The House has not passed that measure. Both the proposed constitutional amendments would need to pass the Iowa legislature again in 2025 or 2026 before they could be placed on a statewide general election ballot. If a majority of Iowans vote to approve the measures, they would be added to the Iowa Constitution.
Thank you, Judith. Des Moines Council skirts rules on public meetings. Small groups meet, talk, development contracts. It's written by Virginia Bereda of the Des Moines Register. Des Moines mayor, city manager, and members of the city council convened behind closed doors and in small groups in February to discuss procedures for development contracts sidestepping Iowa's open meeting law. A discussion on the standard development agreement was initially slated for a public council work session, typically held in the mornings ahead of the general city council meeting. Instead, without announcement or access to the public, two meetings titled Standard Development Agreement were scheduled back-to-back on February the 19th, allowing council members to break off into two groups to discuss the topic, according to calendars the Des Moines Register obtained as public records. The smaller groups meant there was no quorum among council members, and therefore the meetings were not required to be public. A city spokesperson declined to comment on what was discussed during the meetings, but an additional records request of documents provided to the council during and after the meetings revealed city staff made adjustments to development agreement and tax increment financing policies that Des Moines uses to guide conversations and negotiations with developers. Changes include requirements for affordable housing and energy efficiency, such as solar panels and electric vehicle charging stations, for developments getting TIF. The spokesperson also declined to comment on why the meetings were held in small groups without quorums and how often this type of meeting occurs. The Register filed a records request for minutes from both meetings, but the city said none were taken. While small group meetings are allowed under Iowa law, Randy Evans, executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, a coalition that supports open government, said they violate the spirit and intent behind the state's public meetings law. "From my vantage point, it's painfully obvious what's occurring here is that by having less than a quorum present at any one time, it's not a public meeting. They don't have to tell the public that it's being held. They don't have to let the public in, and that lets them work out any disagreements without the public watching," Evans said. "But the whole purpose of a public meeting is to hear what council members say, what is being presented to the council," he said. "And the Des Moines City Council belongs to the citizens of Des Moines. It doesn't belong to the city council members and the city manager." Invited to one meeting held from 7:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. on February 19th were Mayor Connie Bozen, at-large council member Carl Voss, and council member Linda Westergaard, according to a copy of their calendars. Invited to a second meeting immediately after from 8:30 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. were Bozen and council members Joe Gatto and Josh Mandelbaum. Calendars show both meetings took place in the lower-level conference room at Des Moines City Hall at 400 Robert D. Ray Drive. City Manager Scott Sanders also was slated to attend both meetings. Councilmember Chris Coleman was not included in the meetings, calendars show. Some council members' calendars also note that a council work session in the council chambers set for the same morning was canceled. Mandelbaum and Voss confirmed to the Register they attended the scheduled meeting. Bozen said she was present for at least one of the meetings. Gatto declined to comment, and Westergaard did not return the Register's calls. Coleman told the Register he was not looped into the meetings because he was out of town. He attended the evening council meeting by phone. Bozen said no decisions were made. Rather, development staff informed council members of some wording changes to development agreements, changes that staff have the right to make, she said. It was only one item. It was very just informational. So that's why it was done how it was done, Bozen said. We didn't believe it rose to the level of a council work session. She added, it isn't unusual to change or cancel work sessions based on council members' schedules. Under Iowa law, any time the council has a quorum, the majority of members present, to discuss policy matters, the public has to be allowed to attend, and notice of the meeting must be posted at least 24 hours in advance. The law does allow all council members to meet for ministerial or housekeeping purposes, such as monthly expense claims, attending training and events, or meeting socially without public notice. Closed meetings are allowed to discuss things like personnel matters, pending litigation, or the sale of real estate where premature disclosure would adversely impact the price, Iowa law says. According to the Des Moines City Council's procedural rules, a majority of all members of the council constitute a quorum for the transaction of city business. State law also says vacant positions must be included when calculating the number of council members that have to be present for a quorum, according to the Iowa League of Cities. The Des Moines City Council has 7 members, including the mayor, meaning 4 are required for a quorum, even though the city had 1 vacant seat at the time of the February 19th meetings. Evans said he sees this instance of having less than half the members present as an obvious way for the city to circumvent the law. And in doing so, they're not breaking the law to do that, but it certainly is contrary to the spirit of the public meetings law because it deprives the public, the citizens of Des Moines, of the ability to understand the basis and rationale for decisions that the city council makes, he said. Generally, these type of meetings tend to happen when the issue is controversial or where there are strongly held opinions on both sides of the issue, he said. But that is the particular time where it is most troubling because that's an issue that is going to engage more people, and people want to know how their council members feel about it, and the public has been shut out, Evans said. Coleman, who previously served on the city council for 2 decades before he was elected to a new seat last year, said he's never seen an intentional effort to work around open meeting laws. Our city manager and our city legal team is very serious about open meetings and us abiding by the law and holding us accountable for that, and so there's never really an intended effort to violate it, he said. But sometimes they really want to get information in our hands, and it's impossible to get everybody together, and instead of doing 7 meetings, they'll do 3 or 4. Through a records request, the Register obtained 2 documents handed out to council members during the meetings and emailed them to them the next day. One document includes specific changes for developers to meet the city's goals on energy efficiency and affordable housing if they received tax increment financing. For example, housing developments should have at least 10% of the residential units at 65% home rent limits when feasible. Sustainability goals in the revised TIF policy document include provide electric vehicle charging stations and infrastructure to accommodate additional charging stations when off-street parking is provided, install energy-efficient systems like solar panels when feasible, comply with the 2021 International Energy Conservation Code, which provides a national model for energy-efficient residential construction when feasible, participate in Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority's Unlimited Access Partner Program, a contract with a company that allows its employees to ride DART for free when feasible. The second document highlights changes and recommendations city staff members have made to development agreement language that requires developers to follow applicable federal, state, and local laws related to things like workplace safety, payroll records, and unemployment and workers' compensation insurance. This isn't the first time the council members have shied away from openly discussing development agreement standards. On the heels of a contentious mayoral race, Mandelbaum pushed to discuss development agreements for apartment projects in the Sherman Hill neighborhood in downtown Des Moines during a council meeting in November. In a roughly 25-minute speech, he also said the city should explore setting other marks for developers to meet, including environmental and labor standards, and suggested devising a clear framework for staff and developers to consult when outlining the terms of agreements that include tax incentives. While some council members called some of Mandelbaum's points valid, multiple members said it wasn't the proper setting for the discussion. Samantha Grork, executive director of the Central Iowa Building and Construction Trades Council, which comprises 16 local building trade unions across Iowa, said the council has long asked the city of Des Moines to review development agreements to set better construction standards to resolve problems like underpaid or misclassified workers, or to add registered apprenticeship programs for contractors working on a construction project. Grark, who had helped some of those issues, had hoped some of those issues would be discussed in the work session, said learning that smaller meetings were held behind closed doors was like having the rug sort of taken out from under our feet, she said. And it's an important topic for us because it matters. It's a matter of being good stewards of public tax dollars, and why we wanted the conversation to happen in the first place is because we believe that the city can do better on this front, she said. Mandelbaum said these broader discussions over development agreements deserve to be aired publicly. I think it's disappointing that we haven't had a broader, open council discussion on how we address community benefits in our development agreement, he said. I think the public deserves that type of discussion, and I think there's room for improvement in a lot of different ways in our development agreements. Judith?
And as Scott mentioned earlier, there are two photos on page one of today's Des Moines Register with the heading Adventureland Unveils New Scares and New Eats. And in one photo, there it is a scene inside the underground roller coaster. It is very scary indeed. It appears to have a figure shouting in it, and it all looks very dark and lots of craggy mountains. And the other photo is a picture of a pork chop on a stick. And here is the story that goes with those photos. Adventureland to open May 18 with new food and drinks. This story by Chris Higgins. Adventureland will feature a full slate of new food, drinks, and events alongside a reimagined underground roller coaster, just in time for the Central Iowa Theme Park's 50th season. Park officials offered local reporters and influencers a glimpse of the new offerings Thursday ahead of opening day on May 18. Including a tour of upgrades to the underground indoor wooden roller coaster and an opportunity to judge new foods about to debut. The corn dog was crowned the winner. Here's everything new coming to Adventureland this year. Adventureland will debut two new spots to grab a bite or a drink this year. Oink's Restaurant and Bar, with a focus on Iowa pork, and the Falling Star Lounge, with a nostalgic touch to the decor. The new oinks will feature food items that double as Iowa staples, such as pork tenderloins and pork chops on a stick. Pork products will come from the local Birkwood farms. New menu items at the Potato Patch French Fry Stand will include barbecue pork and poutine options. Reporters sampled other new items on Thursday, like Cheetos popcorn, with full Cheetos prices mixed in, pieces mixed in, and cake balls. The new Falling Star Lounge will feature a variety of drinks, while the decor nods to Adventureland's past. Pieces preserved from the former Falling Star ride will be on display, including its bright and colorful lights. Parkgoers also will have new drinks to choose from this year, including a sangria and selection of handcrafted margaritas. Work is underway to test what to put on the rim of the margarita glasses, with a combination of bacon and salt as a possibility. The underground wooden roller coaster, mine-themed ride, will reopen this season with new technology and effects to update riders' experience with a nostalgic feel. One new feature on the ride will be an undead skull jutting out of the wall that comes to life as riders roll by. Adventureland says the underground is the world's only indoor wooden roller coaster. Adventureland's Dippin' Dots locations will have a special new flavor inspired by the underground called Chocolate Brownie Bounty, with cream brownie batter ice cream and brownie batter pieces. The Iowa Craft Beer Takeover event will come to Adventureland this summer as breweries from across Iowa will showcase their beer on select weekends. Breweries taking part in the event will include Back Pocket, Barntown, Big Grove, Exile, Front Street, Keg Creek, Peace Tree, Reunion, Revolution, Single Speed, and Toppling Goliath, according to a news release. Another set of special events will celebrate Adventureland's 50th anniversary, including Bernie's birthday bash in June with an appearance by the park's mascot, and the Festival of Decades in July, which will pay tribute to a different decade each week with concerts, fireworks, and historical displays. Opening weekend is May 18. The park will open 7 days a week from May 25th to August 18. Hours vary, so check adventureland.com to plan your trip.
Thank you, Judith. That concludes our front page stories from the paper. We'll move over to the Metro and Iowa section now. And top story here is mental health disability system revamped. Overhaul merging 32 districts into 7 gets bipartisan approval from lawmakers is sent to governor's desk. This is written by Galen Bacarier of the Des Moines Register. Iowa's mental health and disability services are facing an overhaul under a plan state lawmakers passed Thursday. The proposal, originally made by Governor Kim Reynolds and now headed to her desk, aims to fix what state officials have called a fractured system of local districts and oversee a range of services. And it marks the latest step in Reynolds' year-long efforts to restructure state government. House File 2673 would merge 32 local regions charged with overseeing mental health and substance abuse treatment into 7 unified districts, places disability services under the jurisdiction of the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services, and allows the state to appoint public or nonprofit entities to govern each of the 7 districts. This is a great opportunity for the state of Iowa to see these two worlds merge and to have a system statewide that I believe will benefit Iowans in some pretty dramatic ways, said Representative Joel Fry, a Republican from Osceola. The bill, amended earlier this week to bring it closer in line with Reynolds' original proposal, received wide bipartisan support in an 88 to 8 House vote. 8 Democrats voted against the legislation. Iowa has made significant progress in behavioral health care in recent years, from expanding adult services to establishing the first children's mental health system and increasing funding, Reynolds said in a statement. But more must be done to align services, making it easier for Iowans to get the help they need and for providers to better coordinate their care. The legislation takes the next step to strengthen the system by aligning services statewide. By combining Iowa's 32 mental health and substance abuse regions into 7 unified behavioral health districts, we can provide consistent services, coordinate care system-wide, and, most importantly, improve outcomes for Iowans. Under the new system, behavioral health districts would be charged with coordinating prevention services, early intervention, and treatment support services designed to avoid needing acute care or law enforcement, and crisis services focused on de-escalation, among others. Each of the districts will be governed by a state-appointed entity, either a public or private nonprofit group, and advised by a 10-person council of elected officials, local constituents, health professionals, and law enforcement. Some advocates have expressed concern that key services and programs, including one that links mental health services with police, where crisis intervention experts step in to respond to mental health-related calls rather than law enforcement officers alone, could be disrupted as the system transitions. In addition, the House unanimously approved an amended bill to create an application process and eventually distribute grant money from the multi-million-dollar settlement with opioid manufacturers. Senate File 2395, which was sent back to the Senate on a 96-0 vote, sets out a grant process for the money to be distributed through DHSS and the Attorney General's Office for Treatment and Prevention Efforts to Combat Addiction. We're sending money out the door, and we're also making sure that the money for the future legislatures is there to help future Iowans who may also have this addiction, Fry said. Democrats have previously urged the Republican-led legislature to act on the money and send it out the door, Representative Chuck Eisenhardt, a Democrat from Dubuque, said he had been very critical of decision-making on the issue, but was very pleased to see it moving forward. The legislation now goes to the Senate. Fry urged members to talk to your senators and urge them to move on this bill. Judith.
Valley West Mall sale, many months away. Court-appointed receiver may take a year and a half preparing for the auction. This story by Philip Jones. Almost 2 years after its foreclosure, Valley West Mall may still be as much as a year and a half away from going on the market, West Des Moines Economic Development Director says. In May 2022, U.S. Bank foreclosed on a $42 million loan it made to the mall's then-owner, Watson Centers of Minneapolis. The following month, a Polk County judge approved a plan to auction the mall. But instead of going ahead with the sale, the court-appointed receiver, Krista Freitag of Los Angeles-based E3 Advisors, has allowed the mall to continue operating. West Des Moines, eager to see redevelopment of the prime 58-acre property just off the Valley West Drive interchange with Interstate 235, began talks last fall with Freitag's office. But on Wednesday, the city's Economic Development Director, Ryan Moffitt, said the receiver indicated in February it will spend upward of 18 months preparing the mall for sale. He said, "We do not anticipate any immediate action with the ownership status until then." Opened in 1975, Valley West was once Des Moines' premier mall, but it has since been eclipsed by Jordan Creek Town Center, also in West Des Moines, which opened 5 miles away in 2004. In 2018, Yonkers closed its department store at Valley West, and the Von Maur store there moved to Jordan Creek in 2022, leaving JCPenney as the older mall's sole anchor tenant. The Polk County Assessor's Office valued the buildings at the mall at just $100 last year. A report issued by West Des Moines and neighboring Clive in 2022 described the declining mall with its aging tenant mix as a liability that hinders growth on the nearby University Avenue corridor. Demonstrating the area's potential is West Bank's soon-to-be-completed headquarters between the mall and the interstate, next to where healthcare plan administrator Claim Doc remodeled a long-vacant health club to serve as its home office. Across Valley West Drive from the mall are still thriving Hy-Vee and Target stores, and an empty motel to their south, damaged in a fire, has been demolished. The city is taking steps to get ready for redevelopment, but the process will be slow, Moffitt said. In recent conversations with the receiver and leasing agent Spinoso, the city has said it wants to rezone the property from commercial use to a planned unit development, a zoning type permitting a combination of residential, commercial, and office uses. Moffitt said that would allow the city to provide potential developers with more predictability about what could be built on the property. Some companies have expressed early interest in the property, he said, and once city leaders get a better idea of possible projects for the site, they will discuss tax incentives. Moffitt went on to say, taking this step in the near future would be predicated on an attempt to better position the property when it comes time to market the mall and put it up for sale. I view this as the first enabling step that is necessary to get some movement on selling the property and getting it out of the bank's hands that hold it in receivership.
Thank you, Judith. Man tackled during 2020 protests settles suit. Des Moines to pay $50,000 over claim of false arrest. This is written by William Morris of the Des Moines Register. Des Moines has agreed to pay $50,000 to a man tackled and arrested during the George Floyd protests in 2020, officials say. Approved this week, the settlement is in addition to $25,000 Jacob Saar received from Polk County in 2022, according to a report by Axios. Saar, who now lives in Waterloo, sued both city and county, alleging false arrest and First Amendment retaliation by sheriff's deputies and police. According to court filings, Saar, who is black, attended a protest near the Iowa Capitol on the evening of May the 30th, 2020, but had left that area and was walking on the Court Avenue Bridge with a friend when police fired tear gas and charged a line of protesters. The filings said Saar was tackled by a large group of officers, although his friend, who is white, was not. He was charged with rioting, while his friend was charged with misdemeanor failure to disperse. The rioting charge was later dismissed. The city had asked the court to grant its officers immunity, but a federal judge declined, ruling in March 2023 that it should be up to a jury to decide whether the protesters near Saar were acting violently, whether officers clearly told them to disperse, whether Saar, by walking away from officers, was in fact dispersing, and whether Saar resisted when officers sought to arrest him. A federal appellate court dismissed the city's pretrial appeal, and the case was set for trial in June. City officials and Saar's attorneys did not respond to messages Wednesday seeking comment. Saar is among a number of protesters or bystanders who have accused police of unlawful arrests or use of force during the Floyd protests. The city previously settled one case for $150,000 and has won dismissal or paid minimal settlements in several more, but multiple cases remain pending and courts have repeatedly refused to grant officers immunity for their actions in responding to the demonstrations.
And two short stories here to finish off the Metro in Iowa section today. 7 dead dogs and 60 neglected live animals found in Norwalk home. This story by Jose Mendiola. Police and an animal rescue team found more than 60 severely neglected animals in a home in Norwalk last week. The Norwalk Police Department and the Animal Rescue League of Iowa were dispatched to a home located in the 2200 block of Windflower Drive in Norwalk on April 12 for an animal neglect situation, Chief Greg Staples said in a news release Wednesday. They found 57 live dogs, including some day-old puppies, 3 live cats, and 7 dead dogs inside the house, Staples said. Residents of the house provided enough food and water for the animals, but many had severe medical conditions such as fleas, loss of fur, mange, cloudy eyes, and various cuts that required medical attention, he said. Many of the animals need weeks of treatment, officials said. Mackenzie Mogren, marketing and public relations manager with the ARL, said in a news release, all the animals were crawling with fleas, and many of the dogs and puppies had skin that was red and raw from scratching. Some, including young puppies, had hair loss all over their bodies. There was animal waste and trash spread throughout the house, Staples said. The owner is cooperating with police and has surrendered all dogs and cats to the ARL. Police may file animal neglect charges after the investigation, Staples said. And Polk County crash leaves one man dead. The story by Byung M. Byung. One man was found dead after a single vehicle crash in Polk County Wednesday afternoon. According to a news release from the Polk County Sheriff's Office, officers were notified of the crash south of Northwest 126th Avenue around 2:30 p.m. A preliminary investigation found that the motorist, driving a white GMC Yukon, was traveling westbound on Northwest 126th Avenue, left the roadway, entered a ditch, and went through a fence before coming to a stop in an adjacent field. The driver was pronounced dead on the scene. The identity of the driver has not yet been released to the public, though officers say updates will be sent as they become available. The accident remains under investigation.
Now I guess we'll move on to some national news. Arizona House rejects abortion ban repeal. It's written by Mary Jo Pitzel, Stacy Bartchenger, and Ray Stern of the Arizona Republic, and the dateline is Phoenix, Arizona. Arizona House Republicans twice blocked attempts on Wednesday to repeal a near-total abortion ban that dates from 1864. But Republicans in the Arizona Senate crossed over to vote with Democrats, kickstarting the legislative process required to pass an abortion ban repeal. The House action was orderly and relied on procedural motions, but the result was clear. There was no appetite among most House Republicans to nullify the law that was revived last week by a 4-2 state Supreme Court ruling. Representative Matt Gress of Phoenix was the only Republican who backed the motion from Democratic Representative Stephanie Stahl Hamilton to bring a repeal up for a vote. But without another Republican, the repeal supporters lacked the 31 votes they needed to surmount objections from House Speaker Ben Toma. But in the Senate, Republicans Ken Bennett, T.J. Schaap, and Shwana Bollock joined Democrats to reject three GOP attempts to shut down a vote that to introduce a repeal bill. Bollock and Schaap then voted with Democrats to introduce the repeal bill. The measure, which will be called Senate Bill 1734, received its first read on Wednesday. That means the bill is active but still needs to work its way through the legislative process. The state constitution requires new bills be heard by each legislative chamber on three separate days unless lawmakers approve it with a two-thirds majority. House Democrats vowed to keep up their repeal attempts. This is not going away, said Representative Lupe Contreras, the House minority leader. We'll bring it back to the floor again. Stahl Hamilton, a Democrat who sponsored House Bill 2677, predicted if Republicans continue to refuse to allow a vote on repeal, they will pay a price in this year's elections. We will definitely flip the legislature, she said, echoing Democrats' intent to wrest control from the Republicans. The 1864 law bans abortions at any stage of pregnancy, with exceptions only for the life of the mother. Doctors or anyone who aids in an abortion could face 3 to 5 years in prison. Stahl Hamilton acknowledged that while the failure to nullify the law might be politically advantageous, she lamented that it does nothing to protect pregnant women and health care providers. Wednesday's session was a contrast with the previous week, where Democrats erupted in angry shouts of shame, shame, aimed at their GOP colleagues. Toma condemned those actions and urged lawmakers to refrain from repeating them. I would ask everyone in this chamber to respect the fact that some of us believe that abortion is the murder of children, he said. It is not okay to shout at each other. It is not okay to engage in the kind of behavior I saw on this floor last week. He defended the court's ruling as he urged lawmakers to reject the call for a repeal. The last thing we should be doing today is repealing a law that has been enacted and reaffirmed by the legislature several times, he said. Democrats argued, that HB 2677 deserves a vote. This issue is very simple, said Assistant House Minority Leader Oscar de los Santos. Do we support or do we oppose an 1864 territorial abortion ban? The answer twice over was no. After the first attempt failed, Democratic Representative Alma Hernandez tried again. She argued that Republicans play with the rules all of the time to deny Democrats the ability to have their bills heard. And she reminded lawmakers of the consequences of their actions. There are so many people watching right now and watching what Arizona is doing, Hernandez said, adding that to not even consider a bill that would protect rape victims is appalling. Democrats had counted on Representative David Cook's support for the repeal motion, but the Republican stuck with his caucus. I've never ruled my leadership or my speaker, Cook said. He said he supports a repeal, but it must be done the right way, and waiving the rules isn't proper, he said. Wednesday's actions played out before a House gallery filled with supporters of Arizona's right to life. Bob Pamplin of Mesa said he wanted to see Republicans stand for the unborn, regardless of the political consequences. I'm going to support life, and I think that's what elected officials that say they're pro-life need to do also, not just put their finger in the air and see which way the wind is blowing, he said. Another abortion opponent, Michael Mike Check Rogers, wore a shirt that said Democrats created abortion to control the black population. He said he opposed a repeal of the 1864 law and hoped Republican lawmakers placed protecting life ahead of votes. Still, he thinks the abortion ban needs some tinkering. I don't like doctors being in jail for 2 to 3 years, Rogers said, but I don't think we have to gut the entire law or in order to get rid of those bad branches of the tree. Kathy Herod, president of the Anti-Abortion Center for Arizona Policy, said she was pleasantly surprised to see Gress and the Democrats' repeal bid shot down. But she expected to see another repeal try soon, adding, it's not over until seen die. That term refers to the conclusion of Arizona's legislative session. I probably pronounced that wrong, but I don't know. The 1864 law was revived last week in a state Supreme Court decision that made headlines nationwide. The following day, attempts to push an immediate repeal were shut down by Republicans, triggering loud protests from Democrats. Meanwhile, the state Senate has a busy calendar with non-abortion bills queued up for a vote. There is a chance that if a repeal is approved by the House, the measure could be sent to the Senate immediately, but it would take several days of work before it could be up for a final vote.
From page 7 of today's front section, Columbia University's president says advocating genocide would violate school rules. This story by Zachary Schimarelli for USA Today. Last December, Elise Stefanik, a congresswoman from New York and a Trump-aligned star in the Republican Party, had a standout political moment. A line of questioning she posed to the presidents of two Ivy League universities during a congressional hearing drew widespread condemnation of the college leaders, who would not say whether calls for the genocide of Jewish people violated school policies. The presidents, Colleen Gay of Harvard and Liz McGill of the University of Pennsylvania, both stepped down from their posts in the aftermath. Manush Shavik, president of Columbia University in New York City, was invited to testify before the same panel of lawmakers, but declined to appear at the December hearing because of her travel schedule. As protests over the Israel-Hamas war have continued to roil Shafik's Manhattan campus, congressional Republicans again ask her to testify on Capitol Hill. Her presence in Washington on Wednesday, alongside other university administrators, yielded yet another contentious scene that put campus discrimination under a political microscope. She seemed to have learned from the mistakes of her Ivy League peers. When Representative Suzanne Bonamici, an Oregon Democrat, asked whether calling for the genocide of Jewish people would violate Columbia's rules, she said yes without hesitation. Representative Aaron Bean, a Florida Republican, said, "Columbia beats Harvard and UPenn. Y'all have done something that they were not able to do. You have been able to condemn anti-Semitism without using the phrase, 'it depends on the context.'" The hearing accentuated the bipartisan scrutiny facing college administrators in Washington, as Jewish and Muslim students across the country have reported fearing for their safety on campuses in recent months. Columbia, like many colleges and universities, is under investigation by the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights over allegations of discrimination. But critics, including some congressional Democrats, said the hearing was less of a reflection of Republican concerns over the anti-Semitism students are facing, and more in keeping with a broader campaign of conservative attacks on higher education. In a statement ahead of the hearing, Irene Mulvey, the president of the American Association of University Professors, said colleges and universities are currently witnessing a new strain of McCarthyism. She went on to say academic freedom, free speech, peaceful protest, and associational rights for students and faculty must not be abridged in the name of fighting anti-Semitism. We reject the false choice between promoting a healthy and safe campus culture and promoting free inquiry. Representative Bobby Scott, Democrat of Virginia, criticized Republicans on the committee for failing to acknowledge concerns about the rise of Islamophobia on college campuses as well.
Thank you, Judith. Also from page 7A, 12 jurors, one alternate, seated in Trump trial. Until late Thursday afternoon, jury selection seemed to take two steps back, two steps forward in former President Donald Trump's trial over whether he falsified business records to hide a hush money payment ahead of the 2016 election. Then, in a flash, 13 people were in place. Opening statements can't start until 12 jurors plus several alternates have been selected. As Thursday opened, the case had seven jurors, but right away Judge Juan Merchan excused juror number two due to her concerns about her identity becoming public. He directed the media not to report identifying information about jurors. Several hours later, Merchan dismissed juror number four after questions arose about whether the man had responded truthfully to a question about whether he or anyone close to him had been accused of a crime. The jury quest went on, searching for people who thought they could fairly adjudicate the first criminal trial of a former or current U.S. president. It wasn't easy. Mirroring Monday's proceedings, roughly half the next batch of about 96 potential jurors were immediately excused when they said they could not be impartial. Nine more said they couldn't serve for other reasons. One by one, the remainder were called up to respond to a 42-item questionnaire, and in some cases face additional probing from lawyers. Turned toward the jury box, Trump appeared to be giving each potential juror his full attention. The process crawled. One woman said she had discussed the case with coworkers and participated in the Women's March protest. "It's hard to unring the bell," she said, but gave the judge her assurance that she would follow his instructions on the law and base her decision on the evidence introduced in the courtroom. The judge dismissed another woman who called Trump racist, sexist, narcissist in years-old social media posts. Another potential juror expressed his admiration for Trump, calling him pretty amazing. After the prosecution and defense teams had the chance to use vetoes, two new jurors were chosen, bringing the total back up to where the day began, 7. Minutes later, they were up to 12 jurors plus one alternate. Behind the scenes, the legal pieces kept moving in this and Trump's other cases. The former president's legal team asked to delay a May 9th deadline for his Florida criminal case until 3 weeks after the New York hush money trial ends because the same lawyers, Todd Blanche and Emil Bove, are working on both. Trump faces federal charges in Florida that he retained classified national defense records at his Mar-a-Lago resort. His lawyers are required to discuss filings in a secure facility, which is virtually impossible during the New York trial, the lawyers wrote. Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith argued against a delay because the lawyers have had months to prepare.
And another story from page 5, social media used to exclude Trump jurors. Judge agrees some posts raise fairness concerns. This by Aisha Bashi from USA Today. Former President Donald Trump's trial team is using a powerful weapon in its efforts to come up with a winning jury in his New York criminal hush money case, social media. Two men were struck from consideration Tuesday after Trump's team uncovered social media posts that Judge Juan Merchan concluded raised concerns when it came to their fairness and impartiality in the trial. One potential juror posted, "Get him out and lock him up," about the former president after celebrating that a court struck down a Trump travel ban. When the man was questioned about it and said he still did not believe Trump should be locked up, Trump flashed a smirk. "I don't think that I can allow this juror to remain," Merchan said. The other man posted a parody video featuring Trump that was titled, "I'm done as expletive." He also posted, "No one is above the law," about Trump's separate criminal case dealing with his handling of classified documents. The victories for Trump came as he faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Trump has pleaded not guilty. Prospective jurors may not have realized that their social media post from years ago would be picked over in front of the national media. But jury consultant Joe Allen Demetrius said it is common in high-profile cases. Demetrius, who has worked on many such trials, such as O.J. Simpson's murder trial, told USA Today in advance of Trump's trial that social media would be a key tool in evaluating responses to the list of 42 questions Merchan decided on for potential jurors. Demetrius said, "I would align it to a polygraph test by looking at their oral responses to the questionnaire and then comparing that to what they may have on social media. You can see if they are being forthcoming or if they may be hiding something." There remains the risk that people eager to get on the jury will realize their social media could be checked and erase things in advance, a prospect Demetrius called frightening. Demetrius expressed concerns that Merchan released the juror questionnaire publicly days before jury selection started on Monday. At this point, there is also media coverage of the role social media has played in selection. Demetrius said, "It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out. You are summoned for jury duty in criminal court in New York City on April 15. Well, guess what trial you are being summoned for?" The Trump team did not get Merchan to strike all the potential jurors they wanted gone based on social media activity. Merchan allowed one potential juror to stay in consideration, despite posting a video on Facebook of anti-Trump celebrations on a street. Trump lawyer Susan Nickley said described the video as clearly an anti-Trump event that she is out celebrating and partying at. Before the woman was questioned, Merchan agreed it was an anti-Trump event, but said it wasn't clear the potential juror herself was there. Upon questioning, the woman said she remembered seeing the event as she was walking outside and maintained she could be fair and impartial in the case. Another jury candidate was allowed to stay after Merchan said that her posts were satire and that she had been fairly open about disagreeing with Trump on politics. Yet another potential juror was allowed to remain after the Trump team took issue with a post by her husband, which Merchan said was from 8 years ago.